G'day legends and welcome to episode 17 of The Blokecast. I'm your host Brendan Hardman and today's episode is a little bit different to what we've run in the past. So as I'm sure most people would be aware, if you're not and this is the first time you're listening to The Blokecast, then welcome. You've tuned into an awesome episode, but if as I'm sure most people are aware, I am a veteran. And so Anzac Day holds pretty special place in my heart, the same as it does for, I guess, everyone who has served and majority of the people, I would say, within the community as well. And so today I have decided, well, I say today, but when you listen to this on when it's released on Wednesday, it'll be the day before Anzac Day. It may be up in some podcast platforms on Tuesday afternoon. However, let's we'll see how that goes with editing and the sorts of things. However, most people will listen to it on Wednesday, and that will be pre Anzac Day, the day before Anzac Day. And so today I decided that I would do an actual Anzac Day tribute episode. But don't stress though, the Blokecast will just resume as per normal next week with all of our normal segments, like, for example, Legend of the Week. So it is the most coveted, I guess, award or recognition that you can receive these days is Legend of the Week. And if you want to be Legend of the Week on the Blokecast, all you need to do is jump onto iTunes or Facebook and give us a review. A rating would be brilliant as well. But a review is the key word here. Just jump onto those two platforms, leave a review there for us, and you could be Legend of the Week. So we won't have a Legend of the Week this week because we're about to go through four legends. As I said before, today's episode is an Anzac tribute episode. And today we're going to discuss four absolutely legendary blokes. Four heroes who are recipients of a total of five Victoria Crosses. Yes, you did hear me correctly. Four people, five Victoria Crosses. For those of you who don't know what the Victoria Cross is, it's the highest and most prestigious award for acts of bravery in wartime and can be awarded to any active serving Commonwealth soldier. As such, this was and is a British award that is awarded under the Imperial system, or at least it was awarded under the Imperial system for Australians. And a total of 96 Australians have been awarded the VC under the Imperial system. In January 1991, however, the VC for Australia was approved. And as with the British VC, it is awarded for the most conspicuous gallantry or daring or preeminent act of valour or self-sacrifice or extreme devotion of duty in the face of the enemy. And to date, there have been four recipients awarded with the Victoria Cross of Australia. Today, I'm going to take you on a journey surrounding four of these incredible 100 Australians that have been awarded the most highest award that you can receive while serving in the military. They are Albert Jacka, Charles Upham, Keith Payne, and Cameron Baird. Okay, I'm really excited to get stuck in this episode. Also really excited to test out some new equipment we have here. This is now being recorded on brand new system, and so we'll see how this episode turns out when we get involved in editing. However, as always, let's get stuck in. All right, that's some awesome new music that we just chucked in here. It's just, to be honest, it just comes standard with the kit. However, let's get stuck into this episode. Can't wait to bring this to you. Okay, for those out there that aren't already aware, what does Anzac actually stand for? We do have a lot of people that listen from overseas, so they may not actually be aware of this. So what the Anzac actually means is the Australian New Zealand Army Corps, and it was formed back for World War One, and it was essentially a part of the Australian Imperial Forces that led the charge through World War One. And since then, I guess the story of the Anzac has grown. So when we refer to the Anzacs themselves, we're actually talking about those that served in World War One. However, when we talk about the Anzac spirit, well, that's something that is a little bit different. So what the Anzac spirit or the Anzac legend is a concept which suggests that Australian New Zealander soldiers really possess those same characteristics, specifically these qualities that exemplify us on the battlefield. Those in qualities include things like endurance, courage, integrity, good humour, mateship, a dark sense of humour, really, more than anything else. Really what it is essentially is that we form such a really close bond. So the Australians and New Zealands, we've always had a close bond over the years in the way that we fight and the way that we do things within battle. But there's just always been this myth that, well, we say myth, however, there's a lot of reporting that proves that this is true, that during those times, the Australians and New Zealanders, they fought incredibly hard. They worked together incredibly hard, and they were one of the most influential and dominant fighting forces within that period. And that goes throughout history. That goes throughout today. Australia has quite a small military forces, and New Zealand has an even smaller one. And together, when we combine together, we actually pack a huge punch, a huge, huge punch for what we actually provide. And so in terms of military capability, we're certainly not as big as, you know, those other countries such as the US, Canada, UK, those big, I guess, allied countries that we kind of work with. However, what we do is we punch so far above our weight in terms of the capability that we can bring with soldiers to the battlefield. And that's where we've always excelled. And that's how the Anzac spirit and the Anzac legend or the Anzac myth has really come about. And so our first Anzac legend that we're going to discuss today is Captain Albert Jacker, VC, MC, and Bar. So Jacker enlisted on the 18th of September 1914 as a private in the 14th Battalion, Australian Imperial Force, and trained at Broadmeadows Camp. His unit then embarked on the 22nd December, and he spent 2 months training in Egypt before he actually landed at Anzac Cove on the 26th of April 1915. Early on the 19th of May, the Turks launched a massive counterattack along practically the entire Anzac line. At about 4 a.m., they rushed a place called Courtney's Post, which was a series of trenches that Jacker was actually stationed in at that time. Amid the frenzied fighting, some Turks captured a 12-yard or 11-meter really stretch of trench. One end of that trench was actually guarded by Jacker. For several minutes, he fired warning shots into the trench wall until reinforcements arrived. And after shouting his instructions, he and three others sprang out into the trench. All but Jacker were immediately hit. So he leapt back into the communication trench. And a new plan had to be devised there. Two bombs were then lobbed at the Turks. And just a quick side note here, when we say bombs, we mean grenades. Not bombs like throwing bombs like punches or anything like that. We're talking about grenades here. This is what they essentially called them back in World War One. They were called bombs. And normally they were self-made out of little tins of explosives and with explosives in them. And they would use like ration pack tins and put things like whatever they could find, shrapnel in there to be able to, I guess, deal as much damage to the enemies and as they could. And this was also done to us quite successfully by the Turkish and the Germans during that war. So two bombs were lobbed at the Turks whilst Jacker actually skirted around to attack from the flank. Amid the smoke and the noise, he clambered over the parapet, shot five Turks, bayoneted two, and the rest hastily retreated. He returned back to his section and reportedly told his officer, "I managed to get the beggars, sir." And for this action, he was received the Victoria Cross, the first that was awarded to the Australian Imperial Forces in World War One. His citation for the Victoria Cross read as follows: "War Office, 24th of July, 1915. His Majesty the King has been graciously pleased to award the Victoria Cross to the undermentioned officers and non-commissioned officers, number 465, Lance Corporal Albert Jacker, 14th Battalion, Australian Imperial Forces, for most conspicuous bravery on the night of the 19th to the 20th of May, 1915 at Courtney's Post, Gallipoli Peninsula. Lance Corporal Jacker, whilst holding a portion of our trench with four other men, was heavily attacked. When all except himself were killed or wounded, the trench was rushed and occupied by seven Turks. Lance Corporal Jacker at once most gallantly attacked them single-handedly and killed the whole party, five by rifle, two with the bayonet. It was actually incredible back in World War One the way they actually fought. So if you were to take the way that they fought back then and apply it to today, we would just look at it and, I guess, laugh and say that is ridiculous. And so they were still in the, I guess, in the mindset that it was one side, one line versus another line. So a series of trenches on our side, you have a series of trenches on your side. We line up, we blow a whistle, we jump over the top of the parapet, we run at you with no ammunition. Well, they didn't really have much ammunition, to be honest, at that point in time, because they had a lot of issues with resupply. But we'll run at you with no ammunition, just bayonets fixed, that's it, whilst you shoot us down. And then you do the same to us, we'll shoot you down, and whoever wins, wins. And I mean, that's a very, very bastardized version of, I guess, what was happening during that period. But it was just a different warfare. It was so, so different. You can imagine there was a lot of hand-to-hand combat, which you still do see today. However, it's just not as prevalent as it was back then. And over the years, it's become less and less and less so as we now use our weapons and munitions to be able to deal with those lethal blows rather than having to use hand-to-hand combat. But in Gallipoli and also in France during World War One, majority of the combat really was hand-to-hand. And it was just incredible to think that, you know, you can imagine just lining up there on the edge of a trench with absolutely no ammunition and having someone blow a whistle and then it's your turn to go. Just up and you run and you're in no man's land. There's no cover. There's nothing. And you're just running directly at the enemy's lines trying to break through. There are so many stories, I guess, that we could have told in place of Albert Jacker here that would tell you a similar story. You know, they'd tell you a similar experience, a similar fight. However, this one just stood out to me, not only because he was awarded the VC for this award, but also what followed next. By all reports, he probably should have received three Victoria Crosses throughout his career. Okay, back to our story. So instantly, Jacker became a national hero. He received the £500 and gold watch that the prominent Melbourne business and sporting identity John Wren had promised to the first VC winner. Now, there's a big line right there that is a lot different in civilian terms as it is in military terms. So when we talk about awards in civilian terms, we talk about like Olympic medals, those types of things, we talk about winners. When we talk about awards in the military sense, we never say winners. It's something that military people just don't do. We say recipients or the award was awarded to them. So back to our Jacker story though. His image was used on recruiting posters and magazine covers. And on the 28th of August 1915, he was promoted to corporal. He then rose quickly, becoming a company sergeant major in mid-November, a few weeks before the Anzacs were actually evacuated. Back in Egypt, he passed through officer training school with high marks, and on the 29th of April 1916, he was commissioned a second lieutenant. So essentially in the space of a year, he's gone through half the ranks in the military and become an officer. And so this was common back then. It was I guess it's not that common these days. It's not common at all. It doesn't happen these days. But it happened back then for a number of reasons. It could be that that the person did actually show an exemplary, I guess, leadership skills and promotional worthiness. So he was promoted quickly through the ranks. Most of the time, though, is because they lost so many soldiers, they needed to replace those positions. And so promotions happened a lot quicker and a lot easier, I guess, in that time. The 14th Battalion was then shipped to France in early June, And Jacques Batoon moved into the line near Pozières on the night of the 6th to the 7th of August. And as dawn broke, German troops overran that part of the line. Jacques had just completed a reconnaissance and had gone to his dugout when two Germans appeared at its entrance and rolled a bomb down the doorway, killing two of his men instantly. Jacques charged up the dugout steps, firing as he moved, and came upon a large number of enemy, rounding up some 40 Australians as prisoners. He rallied his platoon and charged at the enemy, some of whom immediately threw down their rifles. Furious hand-to-hand fighting erupted as the prisoners turned on their captors. 50 Germans were captured and the line was retaken. Jacques was awarded the Military Cross for his gallantry, and Jacques was personally credited to killing between 12 and 20 Germans during the engagement. You can see here that, again, we talk about hand-to-hand fighting and how prevalent it was during this time of the war and just this period of warfare. It's such a brutal way to fight. It really is. You know, the battlefields were just full of mud and sludge, and it was so hard to maneuver. And so trying to fight someone in that period with a rifle and a bayonet just would have been horrific. It would have been, would have been horrible. Charles Bean, who was a historian who documented a lot on the World War One, he's done a lot of works, and he described the counterattack as the most dramatic and effective act of individual audacity in the history of the AIF, being the Australian Imperial Force. The entire platoon was wounded. Jacques seriously in the neck and the shoulder. He was sent to a London hospital, and on the 8th of September, London newspapers carried reports of his death. But Albert Jacques was not done. He was far from done. He had been promoted to a lieutenant on the 18th of August, and he rejoined his unit in November and was promoted to captain on the 15th of March 1917 and appointed the 14th Battalion's intelligence officer. Early in 1917, the Germans had retired to the Hindenburg Line on the 8th of April, Jacques led a night reconnaissance party into no man's land near Bullecourt to inspect enemy defences before an Allied attack against the new German line. He penetrated the wire at two places, reported back, and then went out again to supervise the laying of tapes to guide the infantry. The work was virtually finished when two Germans loomed up. Realizing that they would see the tapes, Jacques knew that they must be captured. He pulled his pistol, it misfired, so he rushed on and captured them by hand. Jacques's quick thinking had served the Anzac units from discovery and probable disastrous bombardment. For this action, he was awarded a bar to his military cross. So not only has he been awarded the Victoria Cross, the military cross, and then he is awarded a bar, so he's awarded a second military cross. In September 1919, he embarked for Australia aboard the Euripides. A large crowd, including the Governor General, greeted the ship when it berthed in Melbourne, and a convoy of some 85 cars with Jacques at its head drove to Town Hall, where men from the 14th Battalion welcomed their famous comrade. Unfortunately, he fell ill on the 18th of December 1931 and died on the 17th of January 1932 of chronic nephritis. Nearly 6,000 people filed past his coffin when it lay in state in Anzac House. The funeral procession, led by over 1,000 returned soldiers flanked by thousands of onlookers, made its way to St. Kilda Cemetery, where he was buried with full military honours in the Presbyterian section. 8 Victoria Cross winners were his pallbearers. At his funeral, Albert Jacques was described as Australia's greatest frontline soldier. Few would actually challenge this assessment. Bean and the men of the 14th Battalion, who were fondly known as Jacques's mob, shared the belief that he had earned 3 VCs, and that was in fact that the British snobbery at the time of giving out awards was the reason why he wasn't awarded those 3 Victoria Crosses and instead was given the Military Cross twice. However, there are other reports as to why that happened. He may have risen higher in the AIF, but his blunt, straightforward manner frequently annoyed his superiors. He said what he meant, and he meant what he said, recalls Run one friend. As an officer, he invariably won respect by his example. It was claimed that he preferred to punch an offender rather than to place him on charge. Nevertheless, Jacka seemed to epitomize the Anzac creed of mateship, bravery, fairness, and absence of pretentiousness, which is one of the reasons why I actually chose this story, because he just seems to epitomize everything that we talk about when we talk about the Anzac spirit. The self-sacrifice that he constantly displayed throughout all those battles is just incredible. Our second Anzac legend that we're going to talk about is Captain Charles Upham, VC and Bar. Yes, that is correct. He has won two Victoria Crosses. And as we discussed at the beginning of the episode, Anzac stands for Australian and New Zealand Army Corps. And so Charles was actually a Kiwi. And in September 1939, Charles enlisted in the 2nd New Zealand Expeditionary Force at the age of 30. So a little bit older than most at that time. However, the call for people to fight and to people to enlist was just widespread. However, he was soon promoted to Lance Corporal. He was asked to go to officer cadet training to become an officer. However, at first he declined. And then in December, he was promoted to sergeant. And a week later, they sailed to Egypt. In 1940, he finally joined officer cadet training and was commissioned as a lieutenant. Charles won his first Victoria Cross in March 1941 when the battalion left for Greece and then withdrew to Crete. And it was here that he was wounded in the action from the 22nd to the 30th of May 1941. And this was where that gained him his first Victoria Cross. When informed of the award, his response was, "It was meant for the men," which is an incredible response. And throughout this whole journey, I guess, with Charles, you can see that everything he does for his men. And he's that type of leader, which actually all four people that we talk about today are exactly the same. And it's something I think is missed in civilian workplaces these days. People think that those who work for you, so your subordinates or your employees within the civilian context, that they work for you. So that's not actually true. You work for them. You serve them. Your whole purpose is to get the most out of them and to be the best boss you can be for them. And that's missed, I think. There are a lot of companies out there that struggle with leadership. And a lot of the companies that you do see that really excel and have great leadership styles really focus on empowering their employees. And this is where I think all four of these legends that we're going to talk about today, they really exemplify this type of trait, that everything they did for their men. They did for their soldiers. They did for their team. They sacrificed everything along the way. And in some cases, they sacrificed their life for their team. So the citation for Charles reads as follows. War Office, 14th of October, 1941. The King has been graciously pleased to approve the award of the Victoria Cross to the undermentioned 2nd Lieutenant Charles Hazlitt Upham, 8077 New Zealand Military Forces. During the operations in Crete, this officer performed a series of remarkable exploits, showing outstanding leadership, tactical skill, and the utter indifference to danger. He commanded a forward platoon in the attack on Malim on the 22nd of May and fought his way forward for over 3,000 yards, unsupported by any other arms and against a defense strongly organized in depth. During the operation, his platoon destroyed numerous enemy posts, but on three occasions, sections were temporarily held up. In the first case, under a heavy fire from a machine gun nest, he advanced to close quarters with pistols and grenades, so demoralizing the occupants that his section was able to mop up with ease. Another of his sections was then held up by two machine guns in a house. He went in and placed a grenade through a window, destroying the crew of one machine gun and several others. The other machine gun was being silenced by the fire of his sections. In the third case, he crawled to within 15 yards of a machine gun post and killed the gunners with a grenade. When his company withdrew from Malim, He helped carry a wounded man out under the fire, and together with another officer, rallied more men together to carry other wounded men out. He was then sent to bring in a company which had become isolated. With a corporal, he went through enemy territory over 600 yards, killing two Germans on the way, and found the company, brought it back to the battalion's new position, and but for this action, that company would have been completely cut off. During the following 2 days, his platoon occupied an unexposed position on forward slopes and was continuously under fire. Second Lieutenant Upham was blown over by one mortar shell and painfully wounded by a piece of shrapnel behind the left shoulder by another. He disregarded this wound and remained on duty. He also received a bullet in the foot, which he later removed in Egypt. At Galatas on the 25th of May, his platoon was heavily engaged and came under severe mortar and machine gun fire. While his platoon stopped under cover of a ridge, 2nd Lieutenant Upham went forward, observed the enemy, and brought the platoon forward when the Germans advanced. They killed over 40 with fire and grenades and forced the remainder to fall back. When his platoon was ordered to retire, he sent it back under the platoon sergeant, and he went back to warn the other troops that they had been cut off. When he came out himself, he was fired on by two Germans. He fell and pretended to be dead, then crawled into a position, having the use of only one arm, rested his rifle in the fork of a tree, and as the Germans came forward, he killed them both. The second to fall actually hit the muzzle of the rifle as he fell. He was that close. On the 30th of May at Sfakia, his platoon was ordered to deal with a party of enemy which had advanced down a ravine to the near force headquarters. Though in exhausted condition, he climbed a steep hill to the west of the ravine and placed his men in positions on the slope overlooking the ravine, and himself went to the top with a Bren gun and two riflemen. By clever tactics, he induced the enemy party to expose itself, and then at a range of 500 yards, he shot 22 and caused the remainder to disperse in panic. During the whole of the operations, he suffered from dysentery and was able to eat very little, in addition to being wounded and bruised. He showed superb coolness, great skill and dash, and complete disregard for danger. His conduct and leadership inspired his whole platoon to fight magnificently throughout, and in fact was an inspiration to the battalion. That is just incredible. What he did over those few days was just absolutely unbelievable. Upham was then evacuated to Egypt. He had now been promoted to captain, and he received a bar to his VC for his actions on the 14th to the 15th of July 1942 during the first Battle of El Alamein. The citation read as follows: War Office, 26th of September 1945. The King has been graciously pleased to approve the award of a bar to the Victoria Cross to Captain Charles Hazlitt Upham, VC, 8077 New Zealand Military Forces. Captain C.H. Upham, VC, was commanding a company of New Zealand troops in the Western Desert during the operations which culminated in the attack on El Ruwaizat Ridge on the night of the 14th to 15th of July 1942. In spite of being wounded twice, once when crossing open ground swept by enemy fire to inspect his forward sections guarding our minefields, and again when he completely destroyed an entire truckload of German soldiers with hand grenades, Captain Upham insisted on remaining with his men to take part in the final assault. During the opening stages of the attack on the ridge, Captain Upham's company formed part of the reserve battalion, but when communications with the forward troops broke down, he was instructed to send up an officer to report on the progress of the attack. He went out himself, armed only with a Spandau gun, and after several sharp encounters with enemy machine gun posts, succeeded in bringing back the required information. Just before dawn, the reserve battalion was ordered forward, but when it had almost reached its objective, very heavy fire was encountered from a strongly defended enemy locality consisting of four machine gun posts and a number of tanks. Captain Upham, without hesitation, at once led his company in a determined attack on the two nearest strong points on the left flank of the sector. His voice could be heard above the din of battle, cheering on his men, and in spite of the fierce resistance of the enemy and the heavy casualties on both sides, the objective was captured. Captain Upham, during the engagement, himself destroyed a German tank and several guns and vehicles with grenades, and although he was shot through the elbow by a machine gun bullet and had his arm broken, he went on again to a forward position and brought back some of his men who had become isolated. He continued to dominate the situation until his men had beaten off a violent enemy counterattack and consolidated the vital position which they had won under his inspiring leadership. Exhausted by pain from his wound and weak from loss of blood, Captain Upham was then removed to the regimental aid post. But immediately as his wound had been dressed, he returned to his men, remaining with them all day long under heavy enemy artillery and mortar fire until he was again severely wounded and, being now unable to move, fell into the hands of the enemy when his position was finally overrun by superior enemy forces. In spite of the outstanding gallantry and magnificent leadership shown by Captain Upham, the Victoria Cross was conferred on Captain Upham for his conspicuous bravery during the operations of Crete in May 1941, and the award was announced to the London Gazette dated the 14th of October 1941. King George VI had invested Upham with his first Victoria Cross at Buckingham Palace on the 11th of May 1945. When he saw the recommendation that had been made for the second VC, the King actually remarked to Major General Howard Kippenberger, it's a great name, that a bar to the cross would be very unusual indeed, and inquired firmly, does he actually deserve it? Kippenberger replied, in my respectful opinion, sir, Upham won the VC several times over. Upham's journey definitely wasn't over, though. He was taken as a prisoner of war, and he was sent to an Italian hospital where an Italian doctor recommended his wounded arm be amputated. He clearly didn't want that to happen, so he strenuously refused. He later had the wound dressed by an Allied doctor, himself a POW, and remained in the hospital to recuperate, but attempted to escape numerous times before being branded dangerous by the Germans. One attempt to escape occurred when a group of POWs were being transported in open trucks through Italy. Upham jumped from the truck at a bend and managed to get 400 yards away before being recaptured. He'd actually broken his ankle when he was jumping from the moving truck. On another occasion, he tried to escape a camp by climbing its fences in broad daylight. He became entangled in barbed wire when he fell down between the two fences. When a prison guard pointed a pistol at his head and threatened to shoot, Upham calmly ignored him and lit a cigarette. After this incident, Upham was considered extremely dangerous and was placed in solitary confinement. He was only allowed to exercise alone while accompanied by two armed guards and while covered by a machine gun in a tower. Despite these precautions, Upham bolted from his little courtyard straight through the German barracks and out through the front gate of the camp. The guard in the machine gun tower later told prisoners that he refrained from shooting Upham out of sheer respect, as he could see a group of German soldiers coming up the road whom he expected to capture Upham anyway. Upham was soon recaptured and sent to the infamous Colditz Castle, which was a big POW camp in Germany, on 14th of October 1944. During his transfer on a civilian train, while guarded by two Germans, Upham made his final escape attempt. Upham was only allowed to visit the toilet when the train was travelling at high speed to prevent him from jumping through a window. Nevertheless, Upham pried open the toilet window, jumped onto the tracks, and knocked himself unconscious. Recovering, he made good his escape as far as a nearby orchard, but there really was just no cover or no concealment in that area, so he was recaptured in about 12 hours. By the time Upham arrived at Colditz, there were very few opportunities to escape, and given that the war appeared to be drawing to a close, there really was a little impetus to do so. Upham, along with his fellow prisoners, waited out the remaining months until Colditz was liberated. What is incredible, though, is when Colditz Castle actually was captured by the American forces, most of the inmates made their way home immediately after they'd just been POWs, so for a extended period of time. So you can obviously imagine in those days the Germans weren't that nice to POWs, so it would have been pretty horrific conditions. Upham joined an American unit, was armed and equipped, and wanted to fight the Germans. Upham was keen to see action again, but was instead sent to Britain. Charles passed away in Canterbury on the 22nd of November 1994, surrounded by his wife and daughters. His funeral in the Christchurch Cathedral was conducted with full military honours. The streets of Christchurch were lined by over 5,000 people wanting to pay their respects to him after he passed on. What he went through just alone with the POW side of things is an incredible journey, let alone the fact that he had been awarded 2 Victoria Crosses before that and probably should have been awarded a third. Okay, on to one of my absolutely heroes, I guess. I think every current serving and recent ex-serving military member, this man would be a hero in their eyes, and that's Warrant Officer Second Class Keith Payne, VC and AM. Keith joined the Australian Regular Army in August 1951. And after his basic and initial employment training, was posted to the 2nd Battalion Royal Australian Regiment in December 1951. Payne was transferred to the 1st Battalion Royal Australian Regiment in July 1952, and later that month was sent to Japan as an infantry reinforcement. In September 1952, he was sent to Korea, where he joined his unit. He served with the battalion until they were routed out of Korea in March 1953, whereupon he was taken on strength of headquarters to the 28th British Commonwealth Brigade. He remained with this formation until the end of the Korean War and returned to Australia in 1953. In 1955, he was promoted to corporal and spent much of the next 5 years attending various courses and schools of instruction to further his army career and further his knowledge. Now, we're seeing here that you can see that the rate of promotion in this period of time, which we're talking about the Korean War and then moving into Vietnam War, was a lot different to that of World War One and World War Two, where you'd seen people really jump ranks really quickly. You can see here that Keith really had to, you know, work his way through those courses to get the promotions, which is the traditional way that we do things these days, is that you've got to work your way through a number of different routes, a number of different postings, instructional and both regimental, as well as training to get you up to speed before you are promoted. In February 1960, Payne was posted to the 3rd Battalion, Royal Australian Regiment, then based at Enoggera in Queensland, which is a beautiful place up in the hills, in the jungle. Horrible place to go out field, however, a beautiful place to look at. He was promoted to Sergeant in early July 1961 and deployed to Malaysia in August 1963 during an operation on the Malay-Thai border in October 1964. Payne was slightly injured when he fell into a river. However, he remained on duty and returned to Australia with three RAR in February 1965. He went about doing a number of different postings throughout different units throughout the coming years, and it wasn't until in February 1967 that he was promoted to Warrant Officer Second Class, which was the rank that he remained at whilst he was in the Army. On February 1969, he was posted to the Australian Army Training Team in Vietnam, which is where he was awarded the Victoria Cross. The citation reads as follows. On the 24th of May 1969, in Kontum Province, Warrant Officer Payne was commanding the 212th Company of 1st Mobile Strike Force Battalion when the battalion was attacked by a North Vietnamese force of superior strength. Under this heavy attack, the indigenous soldiers began to fall back. Directly exposing himself to the enemy's fire, Warrant Officer Payne, through his own efforts, temporarily held off the assaults by alternately firing his weapon and running from position to position, collecting grenades and throwing them at the assaulting enemy. While doing this, he was wounded in the hand and arms. Despite his outstanding efforts, the indigenous soldiers gave way under the enemy's increased pressure, and the battalion commander, together with several advisors and few soldiers, withdrew. Paying no attention to his wounds and under extremely heavy enemy fire, Warrant Officer Payne covered his withdrawal by throwing grenades and firing his own weapon at the enemy who were attempting to follow up. Still under fire, he then ran across exposed ground to head off his own troops who were withdrawing in disorder. He successfully stopped them and organized the remnants of his and the second company into a temporary defensive perimeter by nightfall. Having achieved this, Warrester Payne, of his own accord and at great personal risk, moved out of the perimeter into the darkness alone in an attempt to find the wounded and other Indigenous soldiers. He finally collected 40 lost soldiers, some of whom had been wounded, and returned with this group to the temporary defensive position he had left, only to find that the remainder of the battalion had moved back. Undeterred by this setback and personally assisting the seriously wounded American advisor, he led the group through the enemy to the safety of his battalion base. His sustained and heroic personal efforts in this action were outstanding and undoubtedly saved the lives of a large number of his Indigenous soldiers and several of his fellow advisors. Warrester Payne's repeated acts of exceptional personal bravery and unselfish conduct in the operation were an inspiration to all Vietnamese, United States, and Australian soldiers who served with him. His conspicuous gallantry was in the highest traditions of the Australian Army. And that Victoria Cross citation was published in the London Gazette on the 19th of September, 1969. So when we talk about Indigenous soldiers there, what we're talking about is that it was Warrester Payne's job to train the Vietnamese soldiers so that they could fight the battle against the enemy, essentially. Keith Payne was evacuated to Brisbane in September due to suffering from an illness, and he received a warm reception at the airport before entering the hospital. In January 1970, Keith was posted to the Royal Military College, Duntroon, as an instructor. I cannot ever imagine what it would be like to have an instructor that is a Victoria Cross winner, as well as an absolute badass when it comes to, you know, comes to being a warrior. He's just an absolute legend. Payne received his Victoria Cross from the Queen aboard the Royal Yacht Britannia in Brisbane on the 13th of April 1970. However, he also received the Distinguished Service Cross and Silver Star from the United States of America, and the Republic of Vietnam awarded Payne the Vietnam Gallantry Cross with Bronze Star. He was later posted to the 42nd Battalion, Royal Queensland Regiment, and Payne then subsequently retired from the Australian Army in 1975. Still, like the rest that we've discussed, he still wanted to fight though, and so he saw further action as a captain with the Army of the Sultan of Oman against communist forces in the Dhofar War in 1975 and 1976. Sorry if I got that pronunciation wrong there. After that, he actually properly retired and went about his business. And since then, he has been an incredible support to both current and ex-serving veterans. So I guess on behalf of the veteran community, thank you, Keith, for everything that you've done over the years to support us. Our last Anzac legend is Corporal Cameron Baird, VCMG. I chose Cameron Baird because I know a lot of people that knew him when he was alive. He was awarded this posthumously for people who don't already know, and you will know once we go through his story. And from what everyone says, he was just an incredible human being. He was incredibly generous, he was incredibly kind, incredibly caring for his mates, and he had an incredible sense of humour, and he was just an incredible bloke. And so although the other three stories that have been awarded the Victoria Cross of Australia are incredible, and we actually do hope one day we can get a couple of those boys, maybe all of them, on the Blowcast, today I chose to talk about Cameron Baird's story. For those of you who are interested in, I guess, learning more about Cameron Baird's story, there is a book called The Commando, Life and Death of Cameron Baird, VCMG, which was written by Ben McKelvey, and also assisted in that was Doug and Kay Baird, who are Cameron's parents. And a little citation here from General David Hurley, retired, is as follows. The story of mateship, standing by your man, your mate, when there is nothing else left, then leading from the front until your last breath to protect those in your command. Okay, over to Cameron Baird's story. So Cameron Baird was born in Burnie, Tasmania in 1981. He joined the Australian Regular Army in January 2000 and was posted to the 4th Battalion Commando, Royal Australian Regiment, which is now the 2nd Commando Regiment. Baird served in East Timor and Iraq and was deployed 4 times to Afghanistan. He was awarded the Medal of Gallantry in 2007 on his 2nd operational tour. Before we get stuck into that citation, what's incredible about Cameron that I've heard from, I guess, everyone that has that I've spoken to about him in the past is that he was an incredible athlete, and he was able to just – he was one of those people that's able to just pick up anything and do it. And prior to this, he was an incredible footballer. He played for the Calder Cannons and then one game as well for Geelong in the Victorian Football League. He ended up nominating for the 1999 draft for the AFL, which is the Australian Football League, but unfortunately suffered a shoulder injury late in the 99 season and subsequently was not selected by any AFL teams. He joined the Army, obviously, as we discussed before, shortly afterwards. It is incredible to think that this man could have played AFL football, but instead he will forever be immortalised as one of Australia's greatest heroes to have served this country. And so the citation for Cameron Baird's Medal of Gallantry reads as follows. For gallantry in action during close quarters combat in Afghanistan on Operation Slipper, Lance Corporal Cameron Stuart Baird was part of a commando company mission assigned for clearance and search of a Taliban stronghold in November 2007. During the initial phase of the clearance, Lance Corporal Baird's platoon came under heavy fire, and during the ensuing close-range firefight, a member of his team was mortally wounded. Displaying complete disregard for his own safety, Lance Corporal Baird led other members of his team forward under heavy fire from machine guns and assault rifles to recover the wounded team member back to a position of cover. He then re-entered the compound and continued to engage the enemy. Even though under constant fire, Lance Corporal Baird continually moved amongst his team members, coordinating their fire and throwing grenades to neutralize the enemy machine gun positions. Once the close quarter battle had been won, Lance Corporal Baird again led his team forward and began room-to-room clearance, where he was again engaged by several enemies. Lance Corporal Baird continued to lead the fight, killing several enemies and successfully completing the clearance. Throughout the action, Lance Corporal Baird displayed conspicuous gallantry, composure, and superior leadership under fire. He was personally responsible for killing several enemy combatants during the clearance, ensuring the momentum of the assault was maintained, and undoubtedly preventing further members of his section from becoming casualties. His performance and his actions were of the highest order and were in the finest traditions of the Australian Army and the Australian Defence Force. Cameron Baird was on his 4th tour of Afghanistan in 2013 when he was involved in the action for which he was awarded the Victoria Cross. On the 22nd of June, as team commander, he participated in an assault on a Taliban-held village within the Uruzgan province. Shortly after the helicopter insertion, Baird led his team in silencing a number of enemy positions while under heavy small arms fire. He then went to the aid of another team whose commander had been seriously wounded. With selfless disregard for his own safety, he drew the fire from an enemy machine gun position. The bullets were hitting the ground around him, and he managed to suppress the enemy fire, allowing his team to regain that initiative. Once in the enemy compound, Baird forced his way into hostile buildings and intense small arms fire. He charged the enemy's position 3 times to draw fire away from his team. On the 3rd occasion, Corporal Baird's actions enabled the enemy to neutralize and kept his team safe, but ultimately cost him his life. His citation reads as follows. For the most conspicuous acts of valor, extreme devotion to duty, and ultimate self-sacrifice at Gorchak Village, Uruzgan Province, Afghanistan, as a commando team commander in Special Operations Task Group on Operation Slipper. On the 22nd of June 2013, a commando platoon of the Special Operations Task Group with partners from the Afghan National Security Forces conducted a helicopter assault into Gorchak Village, Uruzgan Province, in order to attack an insurgent network deep within enemy-held territory. Shortly after insertion, Corporal Baird's team was engaged by small arms fire from several enemy positions. Corporal Baird quickly seized the initiative, leading his team to neutralize the positions, killing six enemy combatants and enabling the assault to continue. Soon afterwards, an adjacent Special Operations Task Group team came under heavy enemy fire, resulting in its commander being seriously wounded. Without hesitation, Corporal Baird led his team to provide support. En route, he and his team were engaged by rifle fire and machine gun fire from prepared enemy positions. With complete disregard for his own safety, Corporal Baird charged towards the enemy positions, supported by his team. On nearing the positions, he and his team were engaged by additional enemy on their flank. Instinctively, Corporal Baird neutralized the new threat with grenades and rifle fire, enabling his team to close with the prepared position. With the prepared position now isolated, Corporal Baird maneuvered and was engaged by enemy machine gun fire, the bullets striking the ground around him. Displaying great valor, he drew the fire, moved to cover, and suppressed the enemy machine gun position. This action enabled his team to close on the entrance to the prepared position, thus regaining the initiative. On three separate occasions, Corporal Baird charged an enemy-held building within the prepared compound. On the first occasion, he charged the door to the building, followed by another team member. Despite being totally exposed and immediately engaged by enemy fire, Corporal Baird pushed forward while firing into the building. Now in the closest proximity to the enemy, he was forced to withdraw when his rifle ceased to function. On rectifying his rifle stoppage and reallocating remaining ammunition within his team, Corporal Baird again advanced towards the door of the building, once more under heavy fire. He engaged the enemy through the door but was unable to suppress the position and took cover to reload. For a third time, Corporal Baird selflessly drew enemy fire away from his team and assaulted the doorway. Enemy fire was seen to strike the ground and compound walls around Corporal Baird before visibility was obscured by dust and smoke. In this third attempt, the enemy was neutralized and the advantage was regained, but Corporal Baird was killed in the effort. Corporal Baird's acts of valor and self-sacrifice regained the initiative and preserved the lives of his team members. His actions were of the highest order and in keeping with the finest traditions of the Australian Army and the Australian Defence Force. Throughout this episode, we've heard the journeys of four different blokes spread across history, across four different major conflicts that Australia has been in. And to go through and read these stories, share them with you, it leaves me emotional. It leaves me feeling, you know, admiration at first, sorrow, especially for Cameron Baird and his family, but also a great sense of pride, a huge sense of pride for all of our current and ex-serving military members that are out there. Anzac Day will be tomorrow, once this episode is actually posted. So it's on Thursday. And I hope that everyone takes the opportunity to either get down to a dawn service, go along to a march, or at least pause for a minute's silence. Appreciate those who are still currently serving. Remember those who are ex-serving. And remember those who have paid the ultimate sacrifice in service to this country, such as Corporal Cameron Baird. Thank you, everyone, for listening. As I said in the introduction before, the Blowcast will return back to normal next week. We've got some awesome guests lined up and coming in, and a lot of things from sporting guests to other people that work in the mental health environment, to people in business, to some people that are doing some awesome work with organizations like Trojans Trek and Soldier On and those types of things. And so we got some really, really cool episodes coming up. Hopefully we'll have a couple of Olympians coming on soon, which will be really awesome to kind of delve into their mindset and how they kind of achieve everything. And yeah, and at always, at its most, at its best, the Blowcast is here to serve you, to be able to give you guys out there the ability to take back control of your own lives, but also to give you a space where you can come, you can listen, you can be engaged, you can enjoy, you can laugh, you can cry, you can do whatever it is that you want to do in a safe space. So thank you again. Thank you to everyone's support. If you want to be a Legend of the Week, jump onto iTunes, jump onto Facebook. You can be a Legend of the Week by simply leaving us a review. Tell us what you think. This is a bit of a different episode, so I'd love to hear what you guys think. I actually took this inspiration, I guess, from Jocko Willink, who does the Jocko podcast, and that is a awesome podcast. Any military member listening to this who doesn't listen to that podcast, get onto it straight away because you'll love it. And just in general, he's just an inspiration. And so I think everyone should listen to that podcast and listen to him. However, I'd be super keen to know if you guys like this kind of stuff and do you want to see more of it? And it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, that doesn't have to be anything to do with the military. We can do sporting, we can do business, we can do anything. I do love telling stories, and so let's hope that we can continue this in the future. All right, guys, thanks again to everyone, and we'll catch you in the next episode. That song is goddamn catchy. Cheers.